Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our online and radio audiences and our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And it's my pleasure to introduce today Matt Cantor, a columnist for the Berkeley Daily Planet, to speak about the new slavery, what's happening with our prison populations, and the future of work for that. And I'd like to also acknowledge that Wells Fargo and Ernst & Young have underwritten this program for the whole month of August that we've been putting on. So, Matt Cantor.
Thank you, George. Very much appreciate the opportunity. Especially this time, even more than in the previous 2 years, I want to say this is something that I'm very passionate about. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to present this material. Please stay afterwards. This is about, you know, close to a half hour's worth of presentation, and I hope you'll stay and save your questions, and perhaps we'll have a vigorous discussion afterwards. This last February, a small news item came and went without a lot of notice and drew virtually no attention in major newspapers. It was reported first in the Huffington Post and then picked up by a handful of left-wing internet sites. The story told of how CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, a company that runs private prisons, has sent letters to the governments of 48 states offering to buy up all their prisons and end the budgetary woes associated with owning and running prisons. In return, CCA asked two things. First, that the states promise them 20-year management contracts for exclusive rights to run these and any other future prisons in the states. That was not a huge surprise. But the second item is somewhat more troubling, both ethically and politically. CCA asked that each state provide a guarantee that these prisons would remain above 90% occupancy. Let me say that one more time, as if you need it. CCA asked these 48 states to guarantee that the prisons they bought would remain above 90% occupancy. I could stop there, I guess, but just wait. What does it mean for us to contract to keep our prisons full? If nothing else, it's a complete abandonment of the notion of eliminating or even lessening criminal behavior. It says that we are sure that bad people will keep on doing bad things in large numbers and that we can or will do nothing more than continue putting them in huge, expensive cages for long periods of time. The audacity of CCA in proposing such a thing is stunning enough on its own, but sadly, a number of states are considering this proposal. Ohio has done so already. They've made this arrangement. And the pattern of institutional incarceration is clearly moving in the direction that CCA and its competitor, Wackenhut, would lead us. Isn't that a great name? Wait till they put you in the Wackenhut. One of the problems that we encounter as we start privatizing our prison system is that, like all businesses of sufficient size in America, these companies can hire lobbyists to influence legislation. By the way, the ship of privatization has long since sailed, since there are now over 130,000 prison beds being run by the two major players, CCA and Wackenhut, alone. And these numbers are increasing rapidly. In the next few minutes, I intend to show how these companies are spending their money to influence the legislative process, resulting in larger and larger prison populations. The private prison industry has claimed since its inception that government-run jails simply cannot compete with the cost effectiveness of a privately run business model. I'm sure you've heard this. Though it is conceivable that there is some sort of private business model that might do a better job than our current government-run system, it is turning out that this is not the case. And one study by the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, not an independent agency, that's the U.S. government, found that the cost savings promised by private prisons, quote, have simply not materialized. A nationwide study by the Department of Justice found that assaults on guards by inmates were 49% more frequent in private prisons. That's a very large number. That's a really big number. And the same study revealed that assaults on fellow inmates were 65% more frequent. Again, a huge number. This is to say nothing of the increased escapes that have been recorded. In short, it is a lie to say that the government can't compete in the prison business. It is clear that we do a better job at lower cost and keep everyone safer than private prisons have been able to provide. With such good documentation from our government on the failure of private prisons, why are we continuing to privatize at such a rapid rate? Who is CCA funding? How wide is their influence? And why aren't these people being outed by our media? The U.S. is the richest nation in the world and has the largest percentage of its population in prison. At 730 per 100,000 people, or nearly 1% of the population, the U.S. leads the world by a significant margin. If you include prison, jail, parole, and probation, it's over 3%, and that excludes juveniles. Russia, which used to exceed us, is just over half a percentage point. Russia has three times our rate of homicide and is notorious for problems with organized crime and human trafficking. Mexico has about 200 per 100,000, or about one quarter of our rate of incarceration. Though crime rates are higher in the U.S. overall, which surprised me when I discovered that, the murder rate is more than twice as high in Mexico, and drug trafficking and organized crime remain an enormous problem. Canada has about one-seventh our numbers. Are we that much more lawless in Canada? And if so, why? Japan has one-fifteenth our numbers, and below them are many countries we would claim to be lawless by comparison, which you surely cannot say about Japan. These include Pakistan at 40, Liberia at 37, Congo at 26, and East Timor at 20 per 100,000, or 1/40th of our numbers. East Timor, a country we have questioned in its human rights behaviors in the past. What's going on here? Why are so many Americans in jail relative to the rest of the world? It appears to be a blending of two things, profit and punitivity. Everybody loves the politician who's tough on crime, especially in the six-gun culture of America, and nobody loves it more than the business community. Additionally, the construction and filling of prisons is very profitable for those in the prison industry, and business, particularly today, in the wake of the Citizens United decision, has extraordinary influence on politics at all levels. Briefly, this is, for those of you who don't know, and I think most of you do, the Citizens United case was a recent Supreme Court decision that said that there should be virtually no limits on campaign financing since it was equivalent to free speech. I hope this gets overturned. I don't know how you all feel about it, but it seems to be a major atrocity in the political process. Jailing is also a very good way to keep the underclass, the people who flip your burgers for slave wages, very supple, afraid, and compliant. They know all about jails. They interact with the police and the ex-cons on a regular basis, and they know that as bad as things are for them, it's much, much worse in jail. That second cause I mentioned, punitivity, could be the basis of a long discussion all by itself, but let me just say a few words briefly about what sociology has taught us about punitivity. Both Milgram and Zimbardo, do we know these names? A few people, not a few nodding heads. For those of you who know these 20th century scientists, have taught us that punishment and abuse of power are hidden capacities that live inside all of us. All of us. The popularity of public executions in our recent history, to say nothing of mass lynchings, show us that the love of punishment is widespread. Fear and the desire to align ourselves with the powerful and victorious also make us fearful to stand up for the isolated individual who falls on the wrong side of hegemonic power or authority, whoever they are, and no matter how wrong their motivations. Between 1920 and 1970, the U.S. prison population grew from 130,000 to 300,000, a little more than doubling in 50 years. In the next 10 years, it doubled again. And from 1980 to 2006, it grew from 500,000 to nearly 2.5 million, a growth of 500%, while our population grew by only 31%. What is to account for this astonishing set of increases in the last 30 to 40 years? Consider the following as at least a part of the answer, and I don't claim to have all the answers around this. In 1993, near the end of the Elder Bush, the first Bush administration, and as a result of their so-called war on drugs, the percentage of prisoners of in federal prisons for drug offenses swelled to nearly 61%, or nearly two-thirds of the prison population. Aiding in the rapid increase of incarceration over the same period are also two other sets of laws written and sponsored by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. How many of you have heard of ALEC? Wonderful. Which, for those of you over 60, might be called the Bohemian Grove on steroids. ALEC is an organization comprised of lawmakers at all levels of the U.S. government, as well as private businesses and foundations, and functions to write and promote conservative legislation. ALEC has a notably right-wing agenda, as well as a reputation for throwing members of the press out of their meetings. I don't know if you've followed this. It's happening a lot recently. Sort of a what happens at ALEC stays at ALEC policy. One of these two laws is the notorious three strikes law that we know so well, that requires prison sentences for anyone guilty of a felony for the third time, regardless of other circumstances or what that felony was. With three strikes, judges cannot choose more sensible or compassionate paths for people. What's often not understood is that these laws demand prison sentences. The judges cannot make another choice. No matter how inoffensive the strike may have been or how damaging a life in prison will be to that person's life or their family or their community, our nation. The other is a set of laws referred to as truth in sentencing. I didn't know much about this before I started doing research. How many of you have heard of truth in sentencing laws? And we got a small handful, which are, in simple terms, a way to demand that prisoners serve their full term in jail in situations where parole would often substitute for all or part of them. Basically, truth in sentencing is a way to try to wipe out parole. Again, these are laws that take these options away from judges. And remember, both of these laws I just mentioned were written by ALEC, and I'm going to draw other strings together before we're done. By the way, you may have, for those of you who don't know what ALEC is, you may have heard about ALEC in the news this year when a young man named Trayvon Martin was gunned down and killed, and the killer attempted to use the ALEC and NRA penned Stand Your Ground law, which says that it's okay to kill somebody if you believe you have a reasonable basis to consider them a threat. Public outcry at ALEC's role in this, thanks to some liberal press and liberal promoting agencies, drove off some of ALEC's member corporations, including Walmart, ExxonMobil, Shell, Allergan, State Farm, Visa, and AT&T, proving that the press and the death of a handsome young man can occasionally wake people up enough to do a little good. So that was a good thing that happened. Clearly, we're making it harder and harder for the judicial system to do anything but send millions of people into prison when previous generations and other societies did and do manage to find safe, compassionate, economical alternatives. Economist Stephen Levitt of the University of Chicago has identified the growth in the use of incarceration as one of four primary factors leading to the decline in crime during the 1990s and concludes that a quarter of the decrease can be attributed to an increase in incarceration. However, Levitt's model predicts that the majority of crime that is prevented by incarceration is comprised of less socially costly property crimes. Does this approach necessarily represent the most efficient allocation of resources? Levitt seems to think not, stating that the social benefit of radically expanding the prison population through the incarceration of increasingly minor criminals is likely to be well below his anticipated 25%. In a recent article, he notes that it seems quite plausible that substantial indirect costs are associated with the current scale of imprisonment, including the impact on the African-American community, and that, quote, further increases in imprisonment may be less attractive than the naive cost benefit would suggest. They don't call economics the dismal science for nothing. While better than most economists in its clarity, Levitt's bloodless analysis fails to thrust home the blatant truth that incarceration is tearing America's underclass communities apart, particularly the black community. There are more black men in prison today than were enslaved in 1850. Roughly one in three young black males are under some form of criminal supervision, whether imprisoned, jailed, on parole, or probation. A third. And with our recent so-called truth and sentencing laws, more and more are unable to seek parole to move back into their communities. They're sitting in jail. Are they getting better? Are they becoming better people? Are we safer? In the 7 years from 1984 to 1991, there was a 65% increase in the rate of incarceration. During this period, there was an attendant 17% increase in the crime rate. In the following 7 years from 1991 to 1998, the increase in the rate of incarceration was 47%, a slowing down in the increased growth. And this was attended by a 22% decrease in the crime rate. And how many of you are able to follow this? Basically, it's counter. It's exactly the opposite of what we're told. During the same period, Texas had a 144% increase in incarceration, while California had only a 52% increase. Yet, the rate of crime decreased during the same period was slightly greater in California, though both were about the same. Certainly, violent offenders such as murderers and rapists must be dealt with in a manner so as to prevent any danger to the citizenry. I would never argue against that. But that cannot address the astonishing growth in prisons and prison populations, since according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, less than 4% of the inmates have been found guilty of violent offenses. Less than 4%, like 3.6% of the people that we have in prison were guilty of some kind of violent offense. In fact, a graph of rape and murder over the last 40 years is fairly flat, showing almost no rise in this period. Actually, murder and rape have dropped somewhat over the last 20 years. The simple truth of it is that we're very safe in this country and have no good reason to be incarcerating the vast majority of those we currently have in jail. I would argue more than 90%. A useful example of how the law treats wealthy and white offenders as opposed to poor and brown offenders is seen in the judicial results related to cocaine abuse. Since the 1960s, people of all shades have been experimenting with cocaine. Actually, it goes back further than that. From early on, users of powder cocaine needed significant amounts of cash to fulfill their need, while users of newer and cheaper alternative, crack cocaine, could fulfill their need for a far lower price. This quickly began expressing itself in a culture divide in which wealthier white people tended to use powder cocaine, while people of color tended towards crack. In studies of criminal justice involving these two forms of the same drug, a great divide arises. There is a minimum 5-year prison sentence for first-time trafficking of 5 grams of cocaine, which is something like 2 packets of sugar. That's a very small amount. While the same sentence requires 500 grams of powder cocaine. Similarly, there is a 10-year minimum sentence for 50 grams of crack or 5,000 grams of powder cocaine. Why is there a 100-to-1 difference in prison sentencing between these two drugs? When the science shows that the effects are nearly identical, it would appear that it is race or class, if you will, alone that has parsed this issue. Whether our system is geared to punish blacks and Hispanics more than whites, or conversely, to inure or protect whites more than blacks and Hispanics, the effect is the same. Our prisons are being filled to and beyond CCA's wildest dreams, and not with white guys. Again, CCA is the Corrections Corporation of America. Is this accidental or merely the result of good outfielding by CCA and Wackenhut, which is now called the GEO Group? Actually, they changed their name one more time, and I don't have the latest one. Like Blackwater, they keep morphing. If it were not for the fact that CCA and GEO Group are both active members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, it would seem plausible that both of these companies are merely responding in wise fashion to a sad condition in our society, no worse than choosing to be a nurse during a cholera epidemic. To help understand the relationship between CCA and our government, let's take a look at the example of Arizona's Governor Jan Brewer. Anybody know Jan Brewer? Lovely woman that she is. Brewer has two close affiliates with close ties to CCA. The first is Paul Sensman. Sensman is a former lobbyist for the Policy Development Group. I always love these names. Which has CCA as a client. Sensman's wife, Catherine Sensman, is still a lobbyist for CCA through the same consulting firm. Paul Sensman is Jan Brewer's chief spokesman and communications director, about as close as anybody gets to the governor. Brewer's second close tie to CCA is Chuck Coughlin. Coughlin, Brewer's top strategist, runs another consulting firm, High Ground Public Affairs. High Ground lobbies for CCA in the Arizona State Legislature. These two men, Coughlin and Sensman, have also been instrumental in fighting for passage of Arizona's Breathing While Hispanic Law, SB 1070. I'm sure you've followed that as well. That has enabled Arizona to detain and incarcerate even larger numbers, epic numbers. Last year, the numbers were higher than ever for detentions of Hispanics. CCA now operates 7 private-for-profit prisons in Arizona, including 2 that are solely for detention of illegal aliens while they await trial or movement to permanent facilities. Remember that CCA is an ALEC member, and now consider that SB 1070 was written by ALEC as well. And we see how all of this is all tied together. All of this is tied together. And you're not watching it. You're not able to go to the ALEC meetings and see. This is nothing less than a legal scam in which the poor dupes include not only the underclass of Arizona and the illegal aliens suffering in the pursuit of an opportunity to mow your lawn. It is also a game in which we are all dupes, being asked to move our tax dollars away from education and public welfare into systems designed to jail huge numbers of nonviolent individuals being represented as a public threat. Here's a quote from Fareed Zakaria on the cost of prisons from this last March. And I will interject a little correction, because there's one thing that I think he said that wasn't true. In the past 2 decades, the money that states spend on prisons has risen 6 times the rate of spending on higher education. In 2011, last year, California spent $9.6 billion on prisons versus $5.7 billion on higher education. The state spends, and this is the really fun part, $8,667 per student per year. It spends about $50,000 a year on inmates. Each inmate. Why is this happening? Prisons are a big business. Most are privately run. Actually, Zakaria is wrong about this point, but I will continue with this quote. They have powerful lobbyists, and they have bought most state politicians. I think that's probably true. Meanwhile, we are bankrupting our states and creating a vast underclass of prisoners who will never be equipped for productive lives, end quote. ALEC has been busy writing sentencing guidelines as part of their central function of writing model legislation since their inception 37 years ago in 1975. And this is a very good place for CCA and GEO to spend their time and money, since heavier sentencing means more dollars for them, more product. One of these pieces of legislation, and this gets a little tricky, is called the Prison Industries Enhancement Certification Program, which we'll call PI for short. I'm not the only person who uses that. PI eases restrictions on the use of prison labor by private companies, such as CCA, as one prong in a continuing attack on the separation between private business and government-run prisons. This program is allowing large corporations to use prisoners in manufacturing their products. The PI program is being terribly abused by the participating 38 states in ways that allow them to steal private sector jobs from hardworking men and women in every state, to say nothing of creating a profitable, captive labor force. Oversight of this program is provided by the National Correctional Industries Association, NCIA, which is an advocacy group for the prison industry, not a governmental agency. This should be considered an outrage, but it's not in the news, and most of you will never have heard about it. This program diverts a portion of the money deducted from inmate pay, which is already small, to the people who run these labor camps, thus robbing these poor individuals and their families even further and creating even more incentive to arrest, imprison, and enslave vulnerable portions of our society. In order to encourage companies to use inmate labor, these prisons have offered to lease these companies fully operational manufacturing facilities for as little as $1 a year. As a powerful inducement to bring their businesses inside these new workhouses of the 21st century, in the prisons. That's where the factories are being set up. In addition, the inmate workforce shows up every day, receives no annual vacation or other benefits, and receives hourly wages of less than 1/3 of that currently paid to private sector employees of the manufacturing partner. In some cases, wages can be as low as 23 cents an hour. These ploys have attracted corporations such as Walmart, Victoria's Secret. Yes, they're making all that stuff. United Airlines, when you call in to make reservations. Starbucks, Nintendo, Microsoft, Eddie Bauer, and others to close or reduce their operations in the private sector and move them inside the prison fences where they enjoy huge profits for the manufacture and sales of the same products they were making outside prison fences, and in some cases in other countries. They're coming back from other countries and moving their labor forces into prisons. Each month, California inmates produce 250,000 pounds of beef, nearly 500,000 pounds of chicken products, nearly 500,000 gallons of milk, and over 250,000 loaves of bread. Texas inmates produce brooms and brushes, bedding and mattresses, as well as toilet sinks and showers. And since it's Texas, bullwhips. In 1997, Boeing subcontractor Microjet had prisoners cutting airplane components paying $7 an hour for labor that had formerly gone to union workers just outside for $30 an hour. And keep in mind that the PI program takes a portion of all wages and gives it to the prison and program administrators, private individuals, companies that are doing this. Few prisoners actually keep anything nearing that amount of money. In 1997, a California prison put two men in solitary confinement for telling journalists that they were ordered to replace made in Honduras labels on garments with ones that said made in the USA. Is it true? I don't know. You decide. If you call the New York DMV, there's a good chance that the woman who answers the phone will be an inmate. A private Arizona firm uses inmates to make marketing calls for Microsoft and Hitachi. In a particularly bizarre political note, Federal Prison Industries, in 1994, provided prisoners in one of their call centers to remind voters on behalf of congressional hopeful Jack Metcalf that he was pro-death penalty. Metcalf, who prevailed in that election, claimed he never knew that prisoners were making those calls. In Florida, PRIDE, which stands for Prison Rehabilitative Industries and Diversified Enterprises, Inc., you know somebody's doing something bad when they got a name like that, don't you? has become one of the largest printing corporations in the state, its cheap labor having a significant impact on local printers. Jason Brownstein, the owner of J&S Printing in Port Richey, had won approval to be a school district vendor this year, but has been canceled because PRIDE can beat his price by paying workers 55 cents an hour. Brownstein says, I pay $12 an hour to my guys. Who can win? Tampa Bay Times estimates that local printers are losing out on $500,000 in printing from the local school district, just that. Further, because PRIDE's pricing is secret, Brownstein and small business owners like him are less able to compete. How can corporations resist the pull of this business model? And when prisons say, come set up shop inside our fences with virtual slave labor, free overhead, and other financial advantages, how will this not continue as a growing trend? In the words of the former presidential candidate Ross Perot, you can almost hear the sucking sound, remember him, of American industries being drawn into our prison system. Whatever our opinion of capitalism, most will accept that financial incentives shaped by legislation alter markets and can potentially create or destroy entire industries. However, incentives can also be perverse when they either inadvertently or more plausibly by design, but disguised by their designers, create a cure for a social ill that is worse than the disease. In a rush to privatize our prisons, even assuming this privatization to be legitimate, we have allowed our lawmakers to create a dangerous incentive to criminalize ever-growing sectors of our society so that the private prison industry and prison labor industries may profit while attacking and poisoning our social fabric. We have allowed the prison industry to, in effect, outsource jobs to a captive, near-slave labor force with little or no regulation. How does this mesh with our notion of justice? Should prisons be profitable? Should they even be cheap? What do we want going on inside of prisons, and who should be there? It appears to me that the move towards privatized prisons and privatized prison labor is a very dangerous one, and that CCA knew their audience when they asked us to keep their prisons full. They were able to ask that of us because of the level of cynicism and resignation we have adopted with respect to those who, for a range of reasons, cannot follow the regimens of our culture, who become involved in a drug trade because their life circumstances offer little, I would say nothing else often. who cross borders looking for a meager income to send home to their families abroad. The only people who would seem to benefit from this set of choices would be the people who own the prisons, the private companies that are now flocking to the trough for nearly free labor and overhead, and the legislators and lobbyists who enact and enforce the strictures of this strange new world and get funded and reelected to do so. I believe that Americans would not tolerate this new concept of labor if they fully understood it, and that a blindness in our journalism is essential to the propagation of this inhumane trend. Ask your local news agency to pursue this. Ask your legislator their opinion on private prisons and the PI program, if they even know what it is. Social change has always come from those who see a wrong and speak out, from those who will no longer tolerate what they consider unjust. Tomorrow, please, make one phone call.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Matt Cantor speak about the new slavery at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and it's time for questions of the speaker.
I'm not real clear on how the money gets moved around and the inmates wind up with as little as 23 cents an hour. Maybe you could go over that. And I'm curious about how the payroll taxes and withholding taxes are handled by the people who are running these sweatshops.
I've spent the last 3 months doing a tremendous amount of research on this. And one thing, and then perhaps the thing that I'm most stunned by is the darkness of this. This has taken me, what you've been provided with has been my best digging during this time period. I have learned nothing about how these are specifically administered. I don't believe that payroll taxes are involved. The prisons are, the way the PI program works and the way prison labor works, steps completely away from our normal set of rules having to do with the care of and the taxation of these individuals. So I do know that what the PI program is designed to do is to take the wages which come in and pay administration fees to the prison and the people who run all of this. I do not know how much, what these amounts are. And I invite you and anybody, go out, see if you can ask some questions and find out. We should all be finding out more about how this works. It's a good question.
So there's no tax revenue going to the state or the feds for the pitiful wages that they pay?
I don't know that, but I do know that the set of rules which apply are not at all like the way that they are in the outside world, and it's part of why they're able to function the way that they're able to function.
Clearly, the minimum wage rules don't apply. So,
but it's a great question, and I apologize. I just don't know. Hi.
As far as I understand it, the 13th Amendment makes slavery okay if you've been convicted and as part of your conviction. So that is how they get away with, you know, no minimum wage laws. What I've always wondered about this issue is, like workers' comp and OSHA, if someone gets injured,
it's a great question.
As a prisoner, they're taken
care
of as a prisoner.
There's no OSHA in the prisons.
But afterwards, they do not get any benefits.
None of that stuff exists inside of prisons. And it's a huge advantage to these, quote, private corporate partners. Lots of the things that they have to normally, a lot of baselines and strictures that they have to observe in the normal working world disappear magically when you step inside of a prison.
I got rather concerned when I heard you say that call centers
yes.
are often in prisons.
Yes.
I already don't feel comfortable when someone in Argentina or India or the Philippines is on the phone. You know, I don't want to give them, like, my personal information or credit card numbers.
Yeah.
But if they're in prison and if they're, you know, some are actually criminals, I wonder how much unethical conduct can happen from that.
My personal bias is that you have much less to fear than they do. that the way in which they're being abused is the real story.
Yeah, that's horrible.
I'm dubious about this as a real issue, but I don't know. It's a reasonable concern. I think what we should be really concerned about, though, is that those people who you assume are well-paid individuals are not, that they're being treated miserably.
Have you ever heard of an organization called Narconon?
Yes, sure.
I heard someone talk a few years back on when it was introduced into Mexican prisons, and they were very hardened criminals, like murdering more than once even. And it seemed like such an incredible program, a real one to rehabilitate them. That's what we need, because prisons are actually like colleges to make criminals.
Absolutely.
How do you happen to know if the Narconon program is only in very few prisons in this country?
Well, I think we say it Narconon.
Pardon me?
I think it's Narconon. I think it's Narconon, not Narconon.
No, there's one called Narconon.
Okay.
So maybe you don't know about that.
Okay.
But hopefully it spreads. Because...
Yes. They are not.
There's no such thing as rehabilitation in prison. Prisons are set up to keep people doing the work that they are doing. There probably are few African Americans, including myself, who are not directly, maybe marginally, but directly affected by what you're talking about, because we have or we know of someone who has a loved one who is incarcerated. Our sons, our brothers, our uncles.
The kid next door.
The kid next door. Our children, even our daughters now. Mm-hmm. Because increasingly, more and more African-American women are being incarcerated.
Yeah.
And there is no such thing as rehabilitation in prisons. And a lot of this stuff we pay for. We pay for this. All of us pay for this.
$50,000 a year every time you put somebody in jail. Somebody's making money off of that. You know it.
Exactly.
So, that's a very important concept that I think all of us have to make, is that even before this horrible advent of industry enters into the picture, the building and filling and maintenance of prisons is a very profitable business, and those people influence legislation. Those people have been sitting in ALEC and have been lobbying. These corporations that do this even if they're just the people who build the prisons, even before privatization. Private individuals built those prisons. Those people have lobbyists, and they've been fighting to build more of these, which means you got to put more people into them.
I heard that the difference between powder cocaine and crack cocaine was that the crack was much more addictive. Like the first time you took it, you were hooked for life or something. Well, the powder stuff was less addictive. And,
yeah, I
and
read a whole lot about this while I was, when I put that in. You know, you read the science about it, small differences. They're really small differences. And there's a huge number of people in this country who became addicted to powder cocaine. But they weren't poor people.
Yeah, I think they use that as a reason why people should be incarcerated for crack more than powder.
100-to-1
difference. It's kind of a scare tactic almost, I would say, yeah.
And we're talking about trafficking, too. We're not even talking about the ill effects of addiction. And by the way, why would you put somebody who was addicted in jail? They're sick. You put them in a hospital. You put somebody in jail because you don't want to take any chance that they will have contact with people outside. I want to be clear. This is my opinion about prison. Is the only reason you have a prison is that that person has to be always isolated from the rest of the citizenry. So violent people, for sure. But again, that's like 3.5% of the people who are in jail.
I just wanted to say, first of all, I'm really shocked what you said about how it works inside of the prison. But I just want to add a note, because I've been reading a lot about social entrepreneurship, and there is actually some projects where they actually work together with prison, with inmates, to rehabilitate them. So there's, for example, Televerde. They have also call centers within prisons, but they accompany them during they have to stay in the prison, and they set up, they help them like to create their own business when they get out, or they just help them and give them a fair income. And the impact of this organization is like only 10% of the inmates within the 14 years they leave prison go back.
Yeah.
Whereas you look at the other inmates who don't participate in this program, they go back within 3 years, 40%. So the impact is very high of these kind of projects. Yeah. I just wanted to add that.
I would certainly not argue that there aren't some tiny little rehabilitative projects, mostly brought in by outside entities. The problem is, and I really want to be clear about this, the problem is the incentivization in the system. Follow the money, right? Like Deep Throat said. That's what we really need to look at. If it's profitable, things are going to flow that way. That's the danger in this, is that we've made incarceration very profitable, and now we're making it way more profitable than ever before. So it'll actually hurt outside businesses, but it's creating a huge incentive, a suction, to want to build more prisons, to want to imprison more people, to want to keep them in prison for longer periods of time, because somebody makes money off of it. And those people get to influence the process.
Yes. My problem is why did they call it the correctional? You know, why don't we call a spade a spade? I mean, it's like the Defense Department. Why the hell don't they call it War Department?
The Offense Department, yeah. The War Department, yeah. Department. Yes, there was a woman back here. Good call.
You mentioned a couple of detention centers in Arizona that have been privatized for...
There are two that are run by CCA in Arizona.
Is that a trend? Because one of the things I've noticed is under Obama, there's been an incredible increase in the number of...
Illegal aliens
detentions.
Swelled
yes.
up hugely
and
last year.
Do you have a database, say, of campaign contributions and, you know, have you to the politicians? Because you do wonder, is this a trend that will be seen more of?
Well, again, follow the money. I mean, if there's money to be made at it, isn't that a driver in all of this? That's the thing we think we need to worry about more than anything else. So that's sort of my answer to that. But I think your observation is really an important one. There are one of the things I want to say about the detention of illegal aliens is that these are a particularly malleable group of people to move into a labor force. This is already happening. But these people are so frightened when they get taken across the border and incarcerated that they'll do whatever they need to do. And boy, is that's somebody is going ka-ching over that. And it's happening very, very rapidly. And they move them very far away. They move them to these supermax facilities in places like Colorado. And I don't know that yet is a facility. These supermaxes are places where prison industries are occurring yet. But how could they not be ones where that's going to occur next? Yes.
I know there are groups that are fighting three strikes law.
Yes.
Could you name some of them? And have they made any progress?
Well. I think Common Cause is one group which has been attempting to fight that. That's the only group that I can think of off the top of my head. Do a search.
And have they made any
problems? I'm not aware that three strikes laws have been overturned in any state yet. But they should. They absolutely, positively should. If for nothing else, and I would speak to the most conservative person in the room and say, shouldn't it be up to the judge to decide? Should there be any law that prohibits a judge from making their own best judgment? Why else would you have them in that position? Shouldn't they be able to look at an individual who is worse or better than the bandwidth that they're looking at on the law and say, no, 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 you're a really horrible person. We got to put you away. Or say, no, 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 somehow you ended up being in a position where you got arrested for the third time doing this. You were in the wrong with the wrong crowd. We can see you're a good kid. Your parents are standing up for you. You're going to be moved out of state. Well, why put them in jail? They don't have the choice. Yes. George, you want to do this?
I have two questions for you. Number one, is some of the prisons on the stock market? Mm-hmm. And number two, is a lot of California's prisons down near Chowchilla?
I know nothing about the second question, but I understand that both CCA and WAC and HUD are you can buy stock in those companies.
Well, then... then the information of their funding should be available.
That would be great. It would be nice to know that. I don't know what that is. Please, join me. Find out. Write an article.
What's
Send
your
it to
organization?
Me. We'll all include it in an article.
What's your organization?
It's just me. I'm not aware of any organization which is doing this. I did a lot of research. The only ones that I, the articles that I was able to find, the best data I was able to find, was mostly written by, and again, I looked at a lot of Bureau of Prison Statistics material and university press documentation on punitivity, a lot of things like that. But the journalism is just individuals.
I heard something on the radio the other day saying that about 95% of the convictions are plea agreements. They don't even go to a trial or something like that.
Wouldn't surprise me.
It's kind of, you know, getting these people through the system, I guess. And then also another contributor,
sure,
perhaps, to getting people.
And, you know, if you're a wealthy white person, you're more likely to be able to make a positive plea agreement.
The plea agreement is a whole other issue, but it's very fascinating how the prosecuting system has moved in that direction over the last few decades as well. So.
I saw something in the news recently. Maybe somebody is familiar. Goldman Sachs apparently is floating a bond or some kind of a financial instrument where they get paid if the recidivism from, I believe it's New York prisons,
mm-hmm,
goes down.
It's probably a derivative. Sounds like a derivative.
And so I'm not exactly, but it sounds to me a little bit counter, perhaps, to the financial interest in these prison corporations if Goldman is betting that people won't be in prisons, and I'm a little suspicious about that. But the second thing that I have is...
Well, they bet on everything. They've got bets on the... on. You can make a bet in the stock market on anything, going up
so
or going down.
This is the counterparty. But the other question I have is, did you come across any information about the decriminalization of marijuana laws as it relates to...
It was outside the scope of what I was trying to achieve, so I didn't look at that at all.
I don't understand. Could you clarify how... this has to do with legislation and lobbying. What does that mean? And also what PI and some of those things stand for. When they make money from what the prisoners make, do they pay people running for office?
Well,
and then the people running for office will do what for them?
It's really actually not terribly complicated, and I'll say it again. There, you know, we have several different entities in this story, and each of them makes money in some component of this. So, for example, let's say we've got a company like CCA. They're going to make more money when there's more prisoners in there. CCA, as a corporation, can and does hire lobbyists. Those lobbyists lobby to, as in the case of Arizona that I was showing, they go directly to the legislature. Those lobbyists give CCA's money into the PAC funds of people who are running for office with the tacit and, I would say, perhaps, you know, more explicit understanding that they will vote for increased sentencing, that they will vote for the bond to have CCA be hired to build yet another facility, to put more people in, to make more things illegal, to increase the sentencing. And the role that ALEC plays in this is that ALEC is a place where these partners go privately and write this legislation. ALEC writes legislation.
And what do they stand for again, the CCA?
The American ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. They've wrote all the legislation that I talked about this evening. They are a bill mill. That's what they call this place.
And PI and...
PI is short for the Prison Industries Enhancement Certification Program. That is the basically loosening up through legislation of the ability of private companies and prisons to employ people. Formerly, the view of the prison industry, our view as a nation, was that if you are a prisoner, you couldn't be exploited. They could hold you, but they couldn't make money off of you. Huh. So that's been loosened up. That's been teased out by PI so that now, well, I guess it's okay to make money off of them. And that's opening a floodgate.
And CCA means?
The Corrections Corporation of America. That's just the biggest private operator of prisons in America.
Sourcing to prisons?
It's been a gradual process going on over probably about the last 30 years.
And if you talk about, you know, the process of donating money and getting favors back, I mean, all business is a relationship where you give something, you get something. Most of it does not have to be made explicit.
No.
People understand the game. So it's very hard to find the explicit.
Yep.
And now we add to the mix the realignment where the prisoners are going to come from state control to local jurisdictions. Now that Jerry Brown has decided he doesn't want to pay for their upkeep, like what Reagan did with the mental institutions.
Yeah.
And do you have any predictions about how that will work out?
You know, again, I think if you just follow the money, you don't need to parse it that way. You know, as long as it's legal for you to give money to a congressperson. I mean, I just want to challenge this whole notion. We've gotten so accustomed to this notion of PAC funds. That used to be called graft when I was a child. Any money in any fashion that could be that was communicated in any way from a private entity, a company that sold widgets, to Senator, you know, whatever, was graft, and it was wrong, and we all knew it was wrong. When did we stop noticing that that was wrong? And as soon as that went wrong, everything went wrong. Democracy? Say no democracy. It's only democracy if all of us have a voice. And our voices are real. When money can be communicated that way, our voices are way too small. So we have to scream. I do think we can make a difference, but we have to be loud. Go ahead. Who's? Sir.
I'm wondering if this non-legalization of marijuana doesn't tie in with this.
Well, anything that doesn't put people into prisons, obviously, I mean, there's going to be an incentive there. It would be great if we could actually see. I mean, one of the problems with Citizens United is it's blacked out a lot of donation. A lot of this now can be done without any disclosure whatsoever. It would be really interesting to find out who gives money to those campaigns.
That's what my
question
is.
Who buys media time to keep marijuana illegal?
Exactly. Would obviously CCA.
CCA would certainly be one, although probably there's lobbyists upon lobbyists. And again, you know, you get these groups like ALEC. They function as groups, so you don't have to know which individual is involved. Everybody's in ALEC. All the big corporations are there. Yes,
you know,
David.
It's interesting. One point about prison population is that you can never, you know, imprison half of the population, obviously, because somebody's got to run the prisons and stuff like that. And so if you go back through American history and look at what was imprisonable offense and what wasn't an imprisonable offense, it changes over time. In some of the Wild West towns, you know, murder wasn't an imprisonable offense because, you know, you'd have to lock up half the people in town. So you really have to kind of look at it within that context, but it's an interesting shift that we've made in the last 30 years going back towards, you know, increasing our prison populations. And, you know, one element that you haven't covered is there's obviously a lot of money to be made. You mentioned it, but there's a lot of money to be made in the construction of the prisons.
Oh, yes. No, it's a huge part of all this. But now it's becoming a more minor part of it.
A minor part.
Because there's so much money to be made off the labor of these individuals. David.
We've heard a lot over the last few years about the influence of the Prison Guards Union.
Yes.
Now, CCA, being a private company, are they in cahoots with the Prison Guard Union?
Well,
or are they going to squeeze them out later?
I'll bet you there's big fights behind the doors between those two groups.
Yeah, because that's a big part of their costs then, isn't it?
And remember, one of the things that I was mentioning is that in private prisons, those guards are at much greater risk. They do not like this trend. They like working for government-run prisons because they're a lot safer. CCA does not care about their guards, and they pay guards less and less.
All right, we have time for a couple more questions.
So there have been quite a few successful campaigns on websites like change.org. Example of that was with like Bank of America when they increased their like debit card fee. So I was curious to get your opinion on if it were up to you and you wanted to start a change.org campaign around this issue, what would you want to include within that campaign?
What a great question. Well, the first thing I think that's really important is what we're doing tonight, which is there needs to be increased awareness about this. The first thing is most people have no consciousness about this as an activity, that this is going on. So though it is really abstruse, things like PI, the Prison Enhancement Certification, Industry Certification Program, need to be gotten out there. We need to talk about the idea that we're loosening up the belt on the use of people who are in prisons and that population is being made available to Walmart and Victoria's Secret and to call centers, because that alone is going to raise a hue and cry. And then I think we need to overturn that. We need to use that to basically say, you know what, first off, if you're going to have a program like that at all, it can't be administered by a private trade group of prisons. That's no coverage whatsoever. That's Fox and Hen House. If you're going to have people working at all, we have to have the U.S. government providing oversight, the Bureau of Prisons, and compassionate. I mean, it needs to be led by sociologists, not by people who make money. So that's the first thing I would do, is just try to use that to raise awareness about that and overturn PI.
Okay. So what has been the enchantment that has so duped America and pulled the wool over our eyes that has allowed this phenomenon to become the albatross that it is?
Mm-hmm.
How has that happened? I mean, that's not all my question. That's all I can think of.
It's money, honey. You know that.
Wait a minute.
Yes. No. But you don't make money. But you don't make money when Goldman Sachs makes money either, do you? I don't make money when Goldman Sachs makes money. But that's how things operate. So it is the wealth. Huh? We lose money when they lose money. That's democracy. Very good. No. Absolutely. All of us. We're all being sucked in, you know, by this. We all suffer. And I want to say, all of us are morally, you know, in our hearts, hurt by what's going on. All of us should know what's going on in prisons, and all of us should know that this prison population is increasing hugely. And as this woman over here was saying, these are not people from another planet. These aren't even people from another continent. These are our children. These are our neighbors who are locked up in these places of hell. And I would say more and more, because it's profitable for somebody. It's profitable for a Goldman Sachs. It's profitable for a shareholder. That's what we have to really challenge in all this, is that we have to say, we don't care who this is profitable for. We're not doing it. And one of the things that we can do, as I said very early on in the talk, is to point out that there's the Bureau of Justice Statistics shows us that that private prisons don't work. They're a failure. They're an economic failure. So the first thing we need to do is challenge that and say, you know, you guys haven't come through. We're shutting you down, and we'll go back to running our own prisons.
Can you please publish what you've written throughout the country? I mean, who knows about this? I never heard
you guys.
Huh?
Well, there's 8, you know, 70 of you or something. No?
This has been recorded. This lecture has been recorded. Will be available within a week. If you want to tell people to listen in, and that'd be just great. Let me put it into a little bit of perspective, too, because that's what you know, we like to do with all the programs. It's very important that you see things in terms of the incentives that are put in place. It could be that there are, you know, as Matt has talked on another time, on the occasion of evil, it could be that you could just say these are evil people, but there's actually just a set of incentives that keep gradually moving in a certain direction, and that it just keeps building up and building up. That's why when we talk about all kinds of ideas for society, not this one in particular, but all the other ones that are part of the programs that we put on, what I like to focus on is, what are the incentives? Who has set up the incentives? Because you can have a great idea like Social Security, and it can be developed, and it's just a wonderful idea for bringing a safety net into the culture. Hmm. People don't talk about the fact that that was a reaction to communism in order to prevent communism from coming into the United States. There's a lot of other elements. Hmm. But the important thing was that nobody knew that 30 years later everyone would be living to be 75 or 80 years old. People died at 65, and so very few people were going to get that money. So you can't say, I mean, we've got a problem with Social Security that will be a much bigger problem 40 years from now. But it's not incentives. It's not somebody trying to screw everything up, always. Sometimes it is. But most of the time it's that somebody thought well but didn't think it all through for obvious reasons, or just couldn't possibly see in advance.
And by the way,
very, very important part of all incentive structures.
And by the way, if you eliminate CCA, there'll be another CCA that comes along. You can't decapitate them by identifying the enemy. It's the system.
Yeah. And I'd like to, one other element. It's very interesting how certain ideas, we have a great power in culture and a great success. And with that great success, they influence areas they ought not to influence. And the idea here is materialism. We have been so successful in the 20th century improving our material lives that economics and material approaches and answers and incentives have become the way to do all kinds of things. If you go back to my father's generation, there was something that if you were an elite member of society, you got your reward by being paid 15 to 20 times what the workers got paid if you were running a company. But you mostly got your reward as a patriarch in society.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we got rid of paternalism or tried to get rid of paternalism. And how is everything judged now? How much money does that person make? And when a leader of a corporation says, I just made $100 million from my company, he doesn't say, I've helped all my workers. It says, $80 million of that should come to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is because everything is judged by material things. And this material idea has, unfortunately, I mean, not unfortunately, because it's a great thing for lots of people to drag people out of poverty across the whole world. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful thing in many ways. But it is going to go for another 200 years or so before it runs out of being effective. And so I think we need to think about what we need to restrain materialism from getting involved in. And this is a perfect example. There are lots of other ones. But this is where we have to say, no, it shouldn't get into that area too, because that's not where it's really good. That's not going to be really good for us.
Don't forget the military is being run.
And the military is, exactly. The military has the same thing there. Outsourcing the military is a perfect example of the same idea that's going to really backfire on us, really backfire.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So, first of all, there's time for one last question. I know you've been waiting to ask your question for a while, and then we'll have to say goodnight.
It's my understanding that Alex lost a lot of funding, part of that having to do with Rachel Maddow and putting some emphasis on that. Did those companies go back and start funding
again? What
a great
question. That's a great question. I actually tried to look at that. There are a number of companies that have come back to ALEC, although, and a lot of this information is on their website. It's hard to tell precisely what the timing, and a lot of them, there's a controversy. If you go to the Wikipedia page and read about ALEC, there's a controversy in a couple of cases where companies claim to have come back but had nothing to do with that. Oh, no, we never left in the first place, or we came back for some other reason. Always PR attempting to obfuscate that they're basically just trying to not be seen as, looking like cowards.
It didn't take long for Tiger Woods to get his advertisers back either.
No.
So it was a great lecture. Great lecture, Matt.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
So ends yet another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of engaging in enlightened discussion about the issues that affect us all.
It's better than a little block.